Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Before we begin tonight's show, Nick Curto presents the Arantia book, I have an announcement to make. I will be relaunching, as of today, the Olympian Starseeds Initiative, an adventure in living mythology. Olympian Starseeds are embodied reflections of Olympus's light that have chosen to drink the waters of forgetfulness and enter the dream of mortality to assist in the great awakening on Gaia. The Olympian Starseeds Initiative is tasked with locating and liberating incarnate Olympians ensnared by the dream of mortality and reminding them of their Olympian mission. The Olympian Starseeds Initiative, mindful that archetypal Olympian patterns have been programmed into the human psyche, believes in assisting all people on Gaia with actualizing their maximal potential. The Olympian Starseeds Initiative supports all of humanity's efforts to transcend this world, be they metaphysical, mechanical, or even imaginal. And now, Nick Curto. Greetings, Nick. How are you?
Thank you, Hercules. It's a pleasure to be with you as always, and I'm very much looking forward to tonight's guest and the subject matter. I think it's going to be one of the best podcasts we've done. We'll wait till you hear.
I'll be here listening and engineering. If you need me, just give a holler.
Okay, that's excellent, and we'll do that. That's the plan. Again, welcome, everyone. This is Nick Curto presents the Arantia Book, a live podcast for the next hour. I'm Nick Curto, your host. A brief background about yours truly. I now live in Manhattan and have been here for a good part of my life, but I was born and raised in New England, Springfield, Massachusetts, to be precise. I went to the Massachusetts College of Art and Design in Boston. I was president of the Newman Club as well as the Drama Club. But after graduation, I headed directly on a Greyhound bus for New York City to begin my advertising design career. And also, this is important, to continue to explore my ongoing spiritual search as well as other big questions about life that we all have and want answers. I first heard of the Arantia book after I had attended the All Souls Unitarian Church in Manhattan's Upper East Side for two straight years. And then one morning, the minister for his last reading of that Sunday morning read a few paragraphs at the very end of the service, and it was deeply resonating to me, unbelievably so. It was a huge understatement to say that. I felt that it had been, I'd been hit by a spiritual truck in a wonderful kind of way. It was a very powerful moment for me. I wanted to find out much more about that book that he was reading. I found out a wonderful spiritual study group that was focusing on the Arantia book in Manhattan's Soho area, hosted by Robin and Helene Jorgensen. And I've been studying the book now for over 35 years and counting. It has been an expansive, breathtaking experience to explore this inspiring and truly loving book. Now, the word Arantia, spelled U-R-A-N-T-I-A, means our planet Earth. So the Arantia book is the Earth book. It was meant for us, our planet, for all the people in it. I'm a longtime member of the Arantia Society of Greater New York, made up of Arantia book readers from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I've been the past president and outreach chair, and I'm currently serving on the outreach committee. Until the COVID-19 hit, I hosted a Arantia book study group in Manhattan in the West Village, and that was sponsored by the Arantia Society of Greater New York that met the first and third Sundays of each month throughout the year. That was being held at the LGBTQ Center on West 13th Street. I really miss that wonderful group, and I really hope and pray that that group reopens when the venue opens. Hopefully this summer, but we'll see. Time will tell. Now, Also, just to let you know that the Arranger book has been translated in over 28 languages. It is sold in better bookstores worldwide, and you may also read it as well as listen to it on the internet, along with other great information about the book. There's two websites I'd like to give you, so if you take a moment to get a pen and a piece of paper, I will give you both of those websites. They're both excellent. The first one is www.urantiabook.org. I'm going to repeat that, urantiabook.org. And that's the fellowship website, and it's beautifully designed, and it has a wealth of information. I highly recommend it. Also, there's a second website I would really like you to look at, and that is www.urantia.nyc. Also, an amazing website. Recommend them both to you. Okay, let's get right to it. Tonight, my featured guest on the program is a very dear friend and colleague of mine, a long, long-time reader of the Arranger book. His name is Stuart Kerr. Stuart, wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you, Nick, and hello to all my new potential friends, people who I love experimenting and overlapping with bright minds, especially in the light of the Father. So I'm happy to be here, Nick. Nick and I have known each other since well into the 1990s, and I know him as a true and dedicated brother in faith and service. So thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Stuart, for your kind, kind words for me. I appreciate that. I'm going to start right at the beginning, and we're going to go through a little bit about you first, and then we're going to get into one of the most exciting subjects I can imagine, which is where the Arranger book came from and how that happened. It's quite a story, as you know. But let's start off with a little bit about you. First, where do you now make your home?
Okay. Let me give you my executive summary of who I am. I am 67 years old. I am retired. I am pretty much now as a child in a candy shop, enjoying my freedom to do spiritual and revelatory explorations that are available to all of us. And I'm doing that right now. Now, I received the Urantia book as a gift to me in 1974 at the age of 21. 2,100 pages, supposedly under celestial authority, all of these odd things that came to me at such a young age. And I read the book. First I said to the person who gave it to me, I said, I'll read the first 100 pages of this huge 2,100-page book. And I said, I will read it objectively. Now, the first 100 pages go into a revelation that starts with the origin of reality, of God. And God, not just as deity power, but God as personal Father. And the first 100 pages go in depth to introducing any reader to the idea of who God was. So, 21 years old, I received it. I am of scientific background. My profession is as an industrial chemist. I have 14 patents to my name. I have enjoyed a wonderful life of this kind of being paid to do what you want to do, and that's discover new technologies. When I got to the Urantia book, I ate it up. That's where I'm from. This is my representation. Now, in the past, since 1974, I have done nonstop dedication study of understanding what is in this particular book. And all I can just say is now, take it or leave it, but in my testimony, this has been the light of my life, and it has drawn me into a powerful momentum of direction towards God and his light.
Well, I know that's true, Stuart, by your actions and all that you do for the community, and especially the Oranchipal community. Where are you now living? I believe you have a new home location.
Yes, I moved from Wildwood, New Jersey, in Cape May, down on the southern shore of the Atlantic Ocean. And in my 10 years there, I had the ocean come into my apartment twice, filling it up with ocean, which was no fun. But I live in Greensboro, North Carolina right now, which is in the sort of north midwestern part of the state, maybe an hour and a half north of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Are you in a city area, or are you in more of a country setting?
I'm in an apartment complex that services Guilford College. So I am among, right now, education and enlightenment and youth, and I'm in a great position. My move was really critical, but I could not be happier right now, Nick.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. That was a good decision. Now, I've got to ask you, way back when, did you come from a very large family with brothers and sisters, or were you the only child?
Yeah, no, I was the oldest of four children.
I have two
younger brothers and a younger sister.
Okay, and what was your mom and dad like, just briefly?
Pardon me?
I was asking, Stuart, your mom and dad, just briefly, what were they like?
Yeah, okay. Well, my father was a graduate of Princeton University and served within the Naval Reserve Officer Training and went through the whole process there. My mother went to Juilliard on a scholarship for playing harp, classical harp, and she started that at the age of 12. And they met, I think they met. My father was about 20 years old when I was born. So, you know, that's just the way it works. But I had a good beginning of intelligence and balance. Other things, you know, that's how it all works. I mean, every life is unusual and individual.
Right. Were your mom and dad, were they at all spiritual?
No, my father was not. My father was not a spiritual man. My mother was definitely, she became, later in her life, she moved to California, Oakland, San Francisco area, and started to become a follower of Swami Muktananda and went to the ashram there. I actually went with her one time to visit Muktananda's ashram. So that was rather interesting that she got into that particular focus of her spiritual longing.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And also, we just wanted to skip to your schooling. Just briefly, can you just tell us a little bit about where you attended and so forth?
Sure. You know, I graduated. I had no monies to go into college, and I did not get any kind of grants or anything like that. I went to Georgia Tech from being a New Jersey boy, Northern New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen kind of guy, and I went to Georgia Tech because they had the most acceptable finances for me to get a degree, and I was going towards organic chemistry. And in particular, I was very focused on biochemistry, on the ideas of genetics, but also understanding things like cancer and all those things. So I was very interested on the scientific aspect of applied organic chemistry. And I went to Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia, for about 3 years. I ran out of money in my third year. Life fell apart. I had no family background, no help. And I finally recovered myself in New Jersey and finished my degree in organic chemistry at Ramapo College, which is not a pronounced college, but I got my degree. And then I entered in to the profession where I have two main areas of expertise, publications, patents, and so on. One, is polymers. We know what polymers are. They are plastics. They're built of connected atomic structures that build structure. And my area of expertise was something called polymerization, radiation polymerization, using the energy of ultraviolet light focused into a laser focus of energy to create chemical reactions in whatever it's focused on, or sending through a material a curtain of electrons sped up to about one-third the speed of light, and as they pass through the material, they initiate chemical reactions. My job was to create the technology and the chemistry to make those work together. It was a lifetime of exploration into the energy-matter revelation of life, but it also gave me a sense of that I can control it and that I had something to contribute to it. So that's where it was. That's my whole life in terms of profession, the chemical aspect, but I would also say the analytical aspect, the ability to focus in on asking a question about reality and saying, how does this work? What do I need to get done? And is there a way to create something to make it happen? And, I spent my whole life getting paid for that, which is incredible.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it doesn't surprise me at all. And you're such a searching person, and you're very methodical. And I think that I can see how all that happened and how you took it to another level. That's a wonderful story. That really is, Stuart. And I want to ask you, when you were just mentioning how you got the book, for the first part of that year or so, did you read it alone, or did you have other people reading with you, or how did that go?
Great question. When I got the book, I was married. I got married at the age of 20. I got the book afterwards. And it was... What was the question again there, Nick?
Just about if you, say the first year or so, if you were reading that book by yourself or...
Yeah. I read it cover to cover. I read all 2,100 pages when I first got it with a feverish energy.
How long was that?
4.5 months. 4.5 months. And then
Stuart,
I went back.
Extraordinary. That really is.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let me share with you. I went back because up to that time, I had spent all my teen years in studying the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, and truly trying to understand what that revelation was all about. So when I got the Urantia book, it just sort of added on to the whole experience and expanded it and exploded it in terms of correlation of the process of God working in the history manifestation of human history. And we are definitely being infused with spiritual input to drive us towards evolution as a human species.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. Absolutely. It's a very, very exciting time to be alive, and there's so much going on right now. What did you want to find in the Urantia book? Were there any specific things, questions you wanted to find in such a book?
Well, the first one was, okay, I want to give you real quick and dirty. I don't want to spend too much time on the concept here. I had spent my whole lifetime embracing Jesus and his heart. Everything he ever said, what I learned in my Episcopalian church as a choir boy, and things that I heard, everything Jesus said reached my heart and soul. But
yep,
the Father I had an issue
that.
With.
I would say ditto to that, too, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Absolutely. It just resonated so wonderfully to me. I knew I was on the right track. I really did.
Yeah.
From that thing, we're going to go to the focus of tonight is that with your knowledge and research that you've done, obviously, if you could shed some light, and I'll let you go for a while, and then I'll perhaps ask some questions later, but tell us how the Urantia book came to be. How in the world did we get such a document?
Yeah, okay. Let me give you the overall scope.
Okay.
History on this world changed about 2,500 years ago when in the Bible and the Urantia book, they go into detail where Melchizedek, the prince of Salem, approached Abraham and said, "You are going to be the father of many generations and peoples, and that we are going to establish in you something very special." And if you remember, they said Jesus was a priest forever and in eternity of the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was, in the Urantia book's ideology, a divine personality. And he was here to create a pattern that would set us through all the major prophets of Jewish history, leading up to a foundation 2,000 years ago, creator of heaven and earth, Jesus Christ, in his divinity, came in personal manifestation of human flesh and representation. This was all designed, and it is still designed that way. And so that, I mean, that's really what I look at is the momentum of what was initiated then into the appearance of Jesus and his establishment of sovereign authority over his own creation to where we are now with an infusion to take us away from this barbarianism of our human consciousness and to elevate it to God light.
Well said. Well said. That's exactly right. And, you know, the story of Jesus, every time I hear any part of that story, it's always such an amazing thrill and moving experience to understand that story. It is so profound, so beautiful, so many challenges and how things were accomplished. I mean, the story is absolutely amazing. The fourth part of the Urantia book, as of course you know, but I'm just telling our listeners, the fourth part, it's in four parts, is the life and the history of Jesus. And if you're a biblical scholar, if you read the Bible and all that, I think that the fourth part of that book is going to speak to you on such a level, such a deep level of meaningfulness and concern of the facts and the details. You will be astounded. I still am every time I read a passage from that fourth part of the book. I'm sure you feel the same way. Is there any part of that story that especially resonates to you?
Well, let's just say, in my mind, I seek as an individual for cosmic balance and cosmic sanity of the kind that Jesus, in his perfect eternal pattern of humanity and divinity in unity, his pattern established on this world is established in his gospel and his message. But the fact that we can aspire to that kind of, I guess, relationship with the Father is powerful. It says that we are not alone, that this is purposed. Everything that we wished through our whole lives that we wish could be is actually true. But we don't know it until we get a faith trust in the revelation of the Father himself. In our lives, personally, Jesus did it. Jesus spent his whole life saying, "This is the Father. This is, if you want to know the Father, I live by his light and I live by his inspiration." So, yeah, listen, I mean, to me, this right now, I am even more involved with life and energy than I have ever been in my life because I see the vision of it. You know what I'm saying, Nick?
Oh, boy, do I. I share that with you, Stuart. I really do. It's an amazing time to be alive and to have the Urantia book as part of your whole life.
Yes.
Are you there? Stuart, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. I wanted to go back now and take us to Chicago, take us to the beginning of the century.
Yes.
And what was going on and then what happened.
Yeah. First, let me give you the umbrella, Nick. To this world, we have been watched over with celestial overcare from Jesus Christ and his administrative. He is the creator. He is the divine pre-creator personality before he even emerged in human flesh. And the idea that this world has been watched over since the moment we emerged from evolution into God-conscious, aware animals called human beings. And that occurred, according to the revelation, about 1 million years ago. And within that period of time, there have been 5 major ethical revelations to this planet, to humanity as it is evolving. The first one was the establishment of what the Bible calls the planetary prince or the prince of the air. He was a celestial personality to watch over the evolution of humanity on this world under the care of the Father. And obviously he defaulted with Lucifer and really set this world into a spin of which we still feel. Adam and Eve came down. Now, I'll tell you, when I read the book, I didn't think Adam and Eve were ever real. I thought that they were truly mythological figures of alliteration. I never thought that they were real. The Urantia book reveals that they did come here for a major purpose, to upscale the moral, social, and genetic value of humanity, to take us away from animal origin and progress us to a new level. They defaulted in that. The third ethical revelation, as I made mention, was Melchizedek in approaching Abraham and saying, we have a plan for this world. And he worked through 1,500 years and major prophets and establishing a God-conscious, aware humanity within the area of Jerusalem and Galilee. And that's where Michael, the creator of this world, Jesus Christ, came and incarnated in humanity, in the form of humanity. That's the third ethical, or the fourth ethical revelation, is Jesus is the fourth. The fifth is 1955, the publication of this revelation, which we're talking about, Nick, the Urantia book. Now, so that's the perspective of it. Where would you like to go with that perspective, Nick?
Right. Well, I thank you for setting that up that way. That was excellent. It really gives you an overview of what was going on. I want to get to the very specifics about Chicago at the turn of the century.
Yes.
And what was the
and
first,
when this actually, how did it come to the world, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. How, who, or what started, how it progressed. And please, anything you can add to that part, yes.
Yeah. I got a good insight, and it's pretty straightforward. We are revealed in the book that when Jesus came to this world, that they had, at that time, they were saying, through what pair of mother and father are we going to bring a child of divinity into the world? And they tell us that there were three, at the last consideration, three groupings of a man and a woman that they felt could work as a way to bring a foundation of the physical manifestation of Jesus Christ. When they, for the past, according to the history and I guess the traditions of our revelation, from the 1800s into the beginning of the 20th century, the 1900s, that they had been investigating ways to bring a new upstatement of the cosmic sanity of creation into our cosmic consciousness and how best to do it. And they had alternatives. One of the alternatives was William Sadler Sr., his wife Lena, and at that time, when it first made contact, a 5-year-old son, probably thought or jester indwelt, a son called Bill Sadler Jr. And that was the kicker. That's when they said, this is the avenue on which we are going to bring this celestial revelation, upstatement, infusion into the cosmic consciousness of humanity. And that occurred around 1905 when the first contact started. And the question has always been the process. I mean, why not just come down here and create an angel saying, here's the book, etc.? It doesn't work that way. You have to integrate into the cosmic consciousness of humanity in human form. So they brought it here as William Sadler, and they connected to him because William Sadler was a psychologist, but he was also a great theologian. And one of his friends, the man, would go into these states at night, where he was becoming like this automatic connection to something going on. And William Sadler in 1905 and onward was looking for all of these like spiritualists and basically debunking them. But he found that with this man, there was something unusual, and it didn't fit any pattern of all of these celestial supposed interconnections with God and spiritual beings. It was something completely different. And William, so now, there are in this history the recorded what we have been given on it. And by the way, you asked me earlier before I started tonight that there are now currently, I would say, three major foundational biographies of the beginning of this revelation that go into the actual history of William Sadler, of his wife, Lena. There were five within the group that were part of receiving this revelation. Now, it goes into detail. I don't want to just throw that at you now, Nick, but that's generally what we're looking at, right?
Yes, and there's been some question as to how William Sadler found or the what we term, some people term, the sleeping subject. Do you know how that happened, how he came to know that person? Or I've heard a couple of very different versions of the possibility of what happened, how they met.
Yeah, and here's the thing. There is secrecy around it for this reason. The sleeping subject, as you mentioned, it was the sleeping subject who, without abrogation of his God-given free will of personality expression, he was not violated in any way. That was a perfect receptacle to be able to work this energy through into his consciousness without violating his free will soul integrity. And that was so important. It was in other words, as the process was occurring, and it was usually when he was sleeping, that they would then use him. And the reason why they used him was he was not affected to a point where it disturbed him or unbalanced him. It seems to me God has a respect for all persons, and the sleeping subject was special in that whatever they did through him did not in any way detrimentally affect him. That was critical because he did not have to be part of a conscious free will participation. He didn't mind. It was like, okay, so I sleep and I sleepwalk. That's all it was, and it was for him. So what? The key thing was William Sadler took it and utilized it almost analytically like a scientist and absorbed everything he could. And it got to a point where the revelators finally made the decision, like they did with Mary and Joseph for Jesus. They said, Bill Sadler, or William Sadler and his wife Lena and their growing son, Bill Sadler, who is my hero, they are the reason we're going to work this revelation through them and under their overwatch of bringing the integrity of this revelation into the cosmic consciousness of this world. And they spent from 1905-6 thereabout all the way to 1934, where they finally came up with an integral, complete pattern of the revelation that we now know and that was published in 1955.
Right, and the fact that Sadler came upon this person again, do you have any idea of how that actually happened? Like, how was this sleeping subject brought to Sadler's attention?
Yeah, well, there are theories about it. Now, that's where you get speculation, Nick. They speculate because what happened was the gentleman asked to remain anonymous. He did not want his ego presence at all involved in the center of this whole activity, which is extraordinary. Now, there are those within the friendship of Lena and William Sadler Sr. was a gentleman named Kellogg. He's part of the Kellogg family and the tradition of the cereal monopoly back in those days. But people feel, and I think he was part of the Chicago Stock Exchange or whatever, he was not anything special. What he was a perfect receptacle in order for the revelatory presences to deliver this revelation through him without abrogating his personal integrity.
Exactly, and that is quite a feat, and that shows the amount of concern and sensitivity of this event. This is huge, and the fact that they went about it in the most moral way possible, it's quite a story. Would you talk a little bit about William Sadler and his wife's and their quote soiree that they had on Sunday afternoons, a tea, and who was invited, and then what happened when Dr. Sadler asked the people to be absolutely secretive about what he was going to tell them and about what was going on, what he had found, and he asked everybody to swore to secrecy. They had to have that before they could be told what was going on and what he had discovered. Yes. It's quite a story.
It is quite a story. And you know, let me just say to you, William Sadler did not buy into it enthusiastically at the beginning of the process. He did it more like I would as a scientist, to figure out what was this phenomenon of something spiritual into the energy material manifested world. And he looked at it almost like there was a movement in those days to debunk those spiritualists who were doing all their tricks of the trade to pull people into a false sense of spiritual connection. And he was actually out there to debunk those kinds of feelings. What he found is with, and I'm going to say Mr. Kellogg, just because we don't have really a authentic absolute name, but the one who people feel, that he said, I can't see any fraud here. He saw nothing. Now, William Sadler had tremendous theological background in the Seventh-day Adventist movement of that day. So personally, he was very influenced by that Christian ideology and perspective. But the thing was with Mr. Kellogg, he saw no rationale as to, I mean, for instance, this was not like somebody becoming possessed or channeling or anything else. This was a completely new phenomenon that he had never encountered as a psychologist. He was trained as a psychologist to understand, and that was his motivation. So what he did, now here's the thing, in the process, in the 1920s, he brought his friends in to participate with these interactions through the sleeping subject. And in that period of time, they started making connections and communications where the revelators finally say, through the sleeping subject, what do you want to know? In other words, you know, life is like everything you ever wanted to know and didn't even know how to ask. And here they're saying, ask, what would you like to know? and they
spent years. Can you imagine what that was like when that was said to Sadler, and his mind must have just been spinning, absolutely spinning.
Yeah.
You mean I can ask anything? And then he went back to later became
quote. He was fully incredulous.
And
at
said
the beginning,
to them,
Nick,
Would you give us questions that you would like to ask? That was, again, after they promised never to reveal what they were doing or any part of what Sadler was telling them. So I believe they gave him over 700 questions. Isn't that right?
Yeah. It was a and here's the whole thing. When you look at the papers are basically 196 consecutive papers, and each one is a separate essay, but each one is dependent on a progression of the revelation. And the revelators chose, rather than saying, here is what we're going to give you, take it or leave it, suck it down. No. They said, what do you want to know? From the human perspective, they don't look into the integrity of our originality. They say, what would you like to know? So the Urantia book is an evolvement of William Sadler and his group that he formed, the forum and the general group, to ask these questions. And what they would do, I think, on like a weekly basis, the questions would be asked to the revelators. And then the revelators would prepare a statement to address those topical questions. And it was a process that went through to the point where the 1930s, they had reached a maturity that they were getting ready to say, okay, let's unleash the fifth ethical revelation post-Jesus gospel, and let's create a new infusion into this world, and we're going to set this thing through. And that's where, you know, William Sadler, and by that time his son was already getting actively involved, really became very integral on getting the publication effort of all of these papers put together.
Do you have a knowledge, Stuart, of when these questions from this group of dear friends of many different professions was put to the, we'll only call it sleeping subject for the sake of argument, and then these questions were answered? And how were the answers? Was it would the sleeping subject write them down, or did a Dr. Sadler write them down, or did he have anybody else there I believe it was verbal answering the questions.
Yeah, there are ideas, you know, within these realms of interchange with the celestial realities. You talk about things like automatic writing and whatever, where you become under a trance and all of this happens. William Sadler has a document that he put together saying what the revelatory process was of delivery, what it was not, according to the traditions we understand. And what he basically came down to the point was saying, I don't have a full understanding. Now, what they would end up doing, there are today three major books that go through the history of the origins of this revelation. The one that is most traditional, and I think, Nick, this is what you had asked me to prepare, is a book by Larry Mullen, supported by Meredith Springer, key people within the traditions of the Urantia book, called A History of the Urantia Papers. And that's Larry Mullen's, Mullins. Go to Amazon. You can get a used copy real quick within a week. Another one, though, that I love is called The Birth of a Divine Revelation. And analytically, I appreciate his analytical mind. A gentleman named Ernest Moyer, Moyer, The Birth of a Divine Revelation. Now, we have a gentleman who, the Urantia book says, in order to bring concepts of divinity into the mind of humanity, we need patterns that are evolved from human pattern thinking. So they use, and they say straight off in the revelation, we're going to use conceptual patterns that humanity has evolved and created within its own genetic formation. And that they, what they do is they use some of the greatest thoughts and insights that have been generated by human beings and human minds that are compatible with the revelatory perspective. And they do thousands of sources that they use. And in many ways, people say, well, it's plagiarism. You're taking ideas from other sources. Not really, because they paraphrase everything and they reorganize it and coordinate it into a new pattern, which is completely original to the revelatory perspective.
It's an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary happening that did go on. And here we are on a tiny little planet called planet Earth or Urantia, a tiny speck in the universe. Here we are. Here we are in the United States. Here we are in Chicago at the turn of the century, and this incredible, awesome story is unfolding. It is absolutely mind-boggling, and I will take a look at both of those books. I think the first one you mentioned I have, but not the second. But thank you for the recommendation, and I will absolutely go through it. I want to say at this point, Stuart, that I would love you to come back in the springtime. I'll give you some dates and see what's available and continue with this amazing investigation of how the Urantia book came to be. It is an awesome story. I'm thrilled to hear your interpretation of what was going on in your research, and you're very methodical. I love that about you, that you really you take it one step at a time and check everything out. I got to say something else, and I just want to see what your reaction to this. I would think that this story at the Metropolitan Opera would be with an incredible score, would be one of the most thrilling operas ever done, ever. Can you imagine such a thing?
Well,
can you imagine? It's just, as I'm saying this, I'm just like, oh my God, translating this incredible story to a breathtaking opera format. Oh boy, that would just be, I tell you, it would be so amazing. Who knows? Someday that might happen. Who knows?
I want an Academy Award movie that just moves you to tears and joy.
Oh? Yeah, yeah. It's a story that needs to be told, and the effects of it, and then here we have an actual, like you're saying, a gigantic book. When I first saw that book, it had a plain blue cover and the three concentric circles, and to me, it looked like right off the bat like a law book. It just looked like a law book. It was so thick, and I went, "Holy cow!" You know. Would I ever be able to get through it? Well, now I've been through it, I think, four times. And every single time you read a page, you get something new. Don't you feel that?
Oh, yeah. And, listen, I need another three lifetimes, Nick, in this manner of human mind, because I hope to ascend to the next level of higher mind. But in this point, as a tadpole trying to become a frog, I am so graced to be blessed with cosmic insight and cosmic sanity. It changed my whole life from the age of 21, Nick. It has affected the health of my children, of every friend that I have. And that's really just a matter of saying that I truly understand this as being to me, it's just a revelatory gift that I'm in awe of.
What a gift. What a gift indeed. At this time, Stuart, I'd just like to tell our listening audience that if you have any comments, thoughts, or questions for either Stuart or myself, we would welcome that. I'm going to give you my email address, and please go ahead, and we welcome any of your comments or questions, and we'll be happy to answer them. So here we go with my email address, which is NICKNYNY, the numeral 1, not O-N-E, but the numeral 1, at gmail.com. I'm going to repeat it, Nick, N-Y-N-Y-1, at gmail.com. Oh, boy, Stuart, this has been quite a program. It's such an exciting subject, and there's so many facets of this story. It goes on and on. And I'd love to get to some other parts of the story with you. With some of the remaining time, we have maybe, I believe, around 7 minutes or so. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with the listeners, most of which probably have not heard of the Arantia book? Just any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, all I can do is saying, look, people, this is my testimony. This is my revelation and also my worshipful thanks to the Father in heaven for bringing me a sense of balance. I will say to you, in all honesty and sanity, I have never seen anything of such a high level of wisdom and connection and coordinated thought as this revelation. So I live it, I breathe it. I am always going to be out there. I'm like a, you know, in football, an Alabama football fan. You know, I'm crazed on it, but I don't mind. It's my commitment. It is my testimony.
Well said. Well said. Absolutely. It's so exciting to discover the Arantia book, or perhaps the Arantia book discovered us. You know, we can do an argument that way too. But the fact that it is in our life and it has changed. I believe every life that's welcomed this book, given them so much more richer insight into who they are, the relationship to God, the relationship to every man and woman, not only on this planet, but other beings in other worlds. It gets into that. It is one of the most thrilling reads you'll ever come across on so many levels. It unites so many different camps of knowledge, and it's just an incredible blend, this super blend of all this knowledge that is enfolding every single page of this book. Also, another thing, Stuart, I was very amazed by the fact that when you read a paragraph, you probably will have a question. In the very next paragraph, that question is answered. What an amazing way to teach people. Did you find that to be true?
The pattern that you get from the revelatory pattern. I mean, William Sadler's group, every week, he would have questions prepared asking the revelators. So what you get now here, and that's, you know, you're right. The phenomenon when you read through 2,100 pages, you're going to go through, and in an area you sit there and say, I wonder what that means. The very next section, almost like it's answering you in real time, but it's because it follows human pattern of question and desiring. It is so balanced and it just truly insightful of humanity, the way they create this revelation, Nick.
Just on that level alone, it's a thrilling read. It's an absolute masterpiece, and I think anyone who has read this amazing book, their breath is just taken away page by page by page. And it's like potato chips. I remember that when I got the book, I couldn't stop reading it. I think I canceled all my plans for that weekend because I just wanted to keep going with this book. It was that sort of a reaction. It was my gut saying, oh my goodness, this is it. You found something you've been looking for all your life. That's exactly how I felt.
And on that positive note, it's time to start wrapping up and sharing contact information. Thanks for an awesome show.
Oh, boy, was it. Stuart, we owe you. You're an amazing guest. And please, I'm going to ask you if you'll come back in the spring, and we'll go more into this subject, okay?
It's been my pleasure and honor, and I will come anytime desired.
Much love to you, Stuart. This is Nicurto for Nicurto Presents the Arantia Book, wishing you all an enlightened journey. Till next time, please explore the deep wisdom and truly limitless love the Arantia Book has. Stay safe and be kind to one another. Goodbye for now. Much love to everyone out there. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, and thank you very much, Nick and Stuart, for an excellent show. This is Hercules Invictus, and again, I will close with my opening announcement. The Olympian Starseeds Initiative has been reactivated. Olympian Starseeds are embodied reflections of Olympus's light that have chosen to drink the waters of forgetfulness and enter the dream of mortality to assist in the great awakening on Gaia. The Olympian Starseeds Initiative, henceforth OSI, is tasked with locating and liberating incarnate Olympians ensnared by the dream of mortality and reminding them of their Olympian mission. The OSI, mindful that archetypal Olympian patterns have been programmed into the human psyche, believes in assisting all people on Gaia with actualizing their maximal potential. The OSI supports all of humanity's efforts to transcend this world and venture forth into the great beyond, be they metaphysical, mechanical, or even imaginal. And thank you again for joining us. Until next time, this is all of us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures and many blessings. And we'll be closing with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.